Welcome to the second series of the Kintyre Way podcast. In the previous series, my blind dog Jed and I walked the Kintyre Way and spoke to people along the route. In these episodes, we're branching out a little to visit interesting places or speak to interesting people about the area as a whole. Since Jed died, I've been joined on my Kintyre Way themed excursions by three-legged foster dog Mac. This podcast has been sponsored by JS Salmon Limited, Clacken Hydro. In this episode, Mac and I are going on a day trip to Gia. Gia is an island just off the coast of Kintyre and is an absolute must to visit while you're in the area. The 20-minute ferry ride goes from Tainlone, right on the Kintyre Way, and the island boasts good accommodation options, so is well worth hopping over to and staying for several days. To find out more about the island and all the things to do whilst visiting, I spoke to CJ Zammett and Andy York on Zoom, and then followed some of their recommendations when I visited the island a few weeks later.
I'm CJ, I'm the Countryside Ranger here on Gia, and I've been living on the island full-time for 3 and a bit years now. I came to Gia after losing my job as a Countryside Ranger in Cornwall due to COVID, and a friend sent me the job advert, and it was like, well, do you know what? I did a summer on Egg, it can't be that different, and I thought, oh, we'll just go for it, and here we are 3 years later, so it's worked out quite well. The job was like non-existent when we started the project. The project was to put in the pathways and do the historical heritage and things. So we kind of built it up from scratch, and it was literally just an organic process of what the community wanted the Ranger Service to fulfill, basically, alongside obviously the project outcomes. It's busy, really busy, but it's great to be able to respond in that way. So yeah, quite fortunate to be in the position I'm in.
I'm Andy. Andy York, and my wife Karen and I moved to Gia just over 2 years ago. We were empty nested by our children, looking for a move to a more rural location and a renovation project. And we bought the old manse on the Isle of Gia as that renovation project, and we're still in the process of renovating today.
And Gia is an island owned by the community, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Gia basically had a series of lairds for a few hundred years. And in 2002, the community got together, and it was quite a big push from the government to become community owned. So the community got together and decided we'd love to do this. So they got a loan from the government, which they've just paid back recently, which is a wonderful thing. But basically the trust here was established to facilitate development on the island. So there's a housing stock, and that rent goes towards the trust, which is its primary kind of community ownership aspect in a sense. We're funded by the wind turbines, which allows us to carry on with the projects that we have and gives us a turnover and things. But any kind of major decision that needs to happen on island, if it's a development or a big project, has to go to vote for the community. And there's a members meeting, I think, quarterly, so that members are updated with activities of the trust. There's now, I think, 11 or 12 staff members, and we all have a very different role. There's maintenance team, gardens team in Ackermore Gardens, which is sort of like an arm of the trust, really. It used to be a separate trust, but it's now underneath the Heritage Trust and brings in its own income through donations on entry. It's a historic site that was established by Colonel James Horlick in around the 1940s, I think. It's quite a well-known rhododendron collection. It's got some species here that are only found elsewhere in Edinburgh Botanics and can grow things that can only be grown in the Isles of Scilly. Then there's myself in the ranger team. There's an office team, a development manager, estates manager, and some lovely other people that work for us as well in the peripheries. The trust is set up in the way that we have a board that's elected by the community. So there's 7 people on the board. You can have co-opted directors as well that like aim to bring extra skills to the board that maybe don't have, or specific skills like lawyers or things like that. And they basically are the ones that provide the operations, and then the staff just implement that essentially.
And you mentioned the Ackermore Gardens and the rhododendrons there, which brings us quite nicely into the next part of it, which is things to do on Gia. So people that are walking the Kintyre Way, we're hoping that they're going to stay in the area for a little bit and spend a few day trips doing other things other than the straight walking route. And Gia is just the perfect place to spend a day or spend a couple of days, because it's relatively small. Is that right? It's about, is it 6 miles across?
It's 7 miles by one
Thank you.
yeah.
7 miles long by a 7 miles long by a mile wide, by a general quote.
Yes.
Gier is an ideal place to spend a day or two to get a flavour of it. But I would also say that it's well worth spending longer on Gier to get the full experience and absorb yourself into the tranquility and the life of the island.
Quite right too. So can we talk about things to do and things to see? Firstly, getting there. Andy, how'd you get there?
There is a short ferry ride from Teign Lone, which I think is one of the stops on the Kintyre Way. So yeah, short ferry ride where you can, which is a car or passenger ferry, but I assume most people walking will come on as passengers. And the first thing I'd note if you're walking the Kintyre Way is that there's probably more accommodation immediately available to you from a short walk from the ferry terminal at the Gier side than there is in Teign Lone. Not to do Teign Lone down by any means, but we have a fantastic campsite immediately available to any walkers who come off the ferry. There's a couple of properties in the Gier Holiday Lets collection, Ferrycroft 1 and 2, immediately at the ferry terminal. And there's also a yurt at the shop, which is a very short walk from the ferry terminal. So all those things, if you're going to stay a night on Gier while walking the Kintyre Way, might be a consideration. And of course, there's lots more good B&Bs and self-catering accommodation around the island.
I think it's really important to say that actually, you know, Andy's right. Most of the things are within walking distance from when you get off the ferry on Gier. And it's something we've pushed quite hard for is the reduction of car use on the island. So you can get to Gier via public transport. There is a bus that comes down from Glasgow, up from Campbelltown, and obviously up on the Kintyre Way, you guys know that because a lot of people do it in sections, don't they, rather than the whole thing. But it's something we've pushed for really like quite firmly with especially the projects that we've tried to achieve over the last couple of years, because actually Gier is a walkable destination or a cycling destination. Now that we've got 22 kilometers of pathways that, you know, I think half are about aggregate paths and they're wheelchair standard as well. So it means that actually it's accessible as well as just gets you to the places that are really quite nice. But it is something we've tried to do because it was a request from the community. You know, people being on the road all the time was a really difficult and dangerous thing. So the paths have helped to reduce that pressure. And obviously the number of cars puts the pressure on our very small ferry. So we would like, you know, to push the fact that you can come over by foot, which is also a better way to see it, because you're taking a little bit more time to do it and you can do it in more than one day, which helps our accommodation providers and means that, you know, you're not rushing around like doing the Instagram tick box thing, which we're really not a destination for that, to be honest.
We are on the ferry. I've got Mac with me. He's being a very good boy so far. He's not sure about the announcements that I've just missed. I meant to record them, but I just missed the announcements. He's not sure about those, but so far, so good. So, yeah, named Gudi, the Good Isle, by the Norse kin Hakon. The Gaels adjusted the name as time passed, settling on Gier. Noted for its fertile soil from 1700 to 1850, it was without trees until the owner of Ackermore House planted woods around his home. The island has changed owners many times, and a few of those are the McNeils of Tainish, the McNeils of Colonsay, the Scarletts, the Allens, the Hamers, and, in 1944, Sir James Horlick took ownership. We'll talk quite a lot about James Horlick through the course of this. Since 2002, the island has been owned by the community, which CJ speaks about. Yeah, so, right, I'm going to stop recording because Max realised that he's moving and is not entirely convinced that it's a good idea. I'll see you on Gier.
What would you recommend doing? That's a really broad, open question, but we'll just kick us off with the must-sees if you're going to visit Gier.
Okay, so you've already mentioned what many people consider the jewel in the crown of Gaea, and that's Achamore Gardens. Achamore has again improved significantly during my time on the island due to the appointment of a head gardener 3 years ago who has a real passion for the refurbishment and revival of the gardens as a centrepiece to the island. CJ's mentioned the rhododendron collection built by Colonel Horlicks, and that is something that Midsummer and beyond is a fantastic sight to see. That and the Camellia Walk that's visible from the central house itself is absolutely superb. There are, as CJ says, good accessible paths around the garden suitable for wheelchair users. And just, I would encourage anyone to come and see the gardens at different times of the year, because the colours in the summer are superb, but equally, I walk at least once a week in there in the winter, and the colours change from season to season. And it really is a superb centre point to walk to from the ferry and see as part of your journey.
I think Colonel Horlicks was a very, very clever man. The things that he planted did owe to the fact that there would be something in flower all year round, and there would be a series of rhododendrons also in flower, which is like quite a brilliant thing to be able to say. But Bryony, the head gardener, has also pushed really hard in our time here for biodiversity aspect as well. So it's not just about creating an ornamental garden that's, you know, beautiful and it's like something out of the botanics. It's for wildlife benefit as well. But also the other thing is the edibles in Achamore Gardens are used within Gaea Gin from Ben and Tack down in, where is it, Torresdale, I think. So yeah, Achamore Gardens was a really big part of that when they did the botanicals for that gin, which was for the anniversary of the buyout over here, which was a great thing. Everybody loves to say that they've tasted the gin so that they need to come to Achamore Gardens to have a look at where they've grown. So that's a really good thing that Bryony did as well. But yeah, I think Achamore is just one of those places that is quite unique on this side of Scotland as well. If you go to an island, you really don't expect to go and see a botanic garden. So I think it really does lend itself quite well to our small little place.
Mac and I have made our way to Achamore Gardens and met with CJ in real life, and we're here at the pond.
Yeah, so this is the pond. In, I think, 2020, the head gardener was put into post. So before she was here, not much work had been done in the gardens. It was all volunteer-based. And now that she's here, this area that we're looking at was completely stagnant. There was no movement of water, and it just meant that there was no life. Now it's a completely different situation. So we've got an outflow on the south side and on the north side, and it's meant that like life is thriving in here. So even last year we did like a pond dipping session with the kids, and they were just like blown away by the number of newts and amazing creatures that are in there. So it's really cool. And then obviously that benefits things like the birds. And we've got this line of alder trees just here. Little Robin lives in here, and he's kind of like adopted the behaviors of a flycatcher. So he like skims the water's edge and gets all the little bugs and beasties, and then flies back into the trees. And like, that's not normal Robin behavior. So it's actually really cool to see. And then there's lots of herons, and they sort of like sit around. Got a couple of heronries nearby. And yeah, even last week we had a white-tailed eagle in here, which was amazing.
All the way down into the gardens?
Yeah, he just perched himself in the Scots pine just back there. And then flew over the pond and then out to Gala Hill. It was amazing.
That's incredible.
Totally amazing. But it's just like a real testament to the head gardener, really, because she's like an ex-countryside ranger. Mm-hmm. And now she's come into this like ornamental space and sort of made it like ornamental but positive for biodiversity. Yeah, it's really good. It's really good at this time of year. I actually prefer the winter on Gaea because you can see so much more.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can pick out the ornamental trees from the native trees really easily if you're like learning about different bits of biodiversity and things. Like, some of the flowers may not be up yet, but Colonel Horlicks planted a rhododendron to be in flower at every time of year. You can just see the top of one through there.
Yes, the white one.
Yeah. So that area is closed just now because of storm damage with the trees. But like, even there's one down here that we might be able to go and have a look at. So there's always something in colour, which is amazing. This one behind us is literally just about to come out, which is pretty cool.
See, it's got
huge buds. Yeah, it's amazing. So yeah, it's just really nice this time of year because you can see everything. And like, even just today now, you've got like the daffodils, the red dogwood, you've got the green ferns, you've got the water hawthorn that's on the top there. I just think it looks really special. And you just know it's like that whole Secret Garden effect, you know, like when in the start of the film there's nothing,
yeah,
but you know it's going to be amazing. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, you can see what's about to shoot up.
Yeah, and like the gardeners are a bit creative in their stance. Like you can see the sort of like artistic bits they put in, like the standing stones there, and these are just plant structures, but they've done a little bit in the walled gardens where they're all shapes and different dead hedges in the shape of snakes and, you know, all of that kind of thing. So it's actually quite sculptural when you get your eye in and you look at different bits. Like there's a carved otter over there. Can you see him?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Gosh.
There's lots of little things like that, which are really nice.
This is the sort of place, the more you just stand and look, then you just start to see more and more things.
It's so cool. Yeah.
Lovely crocuses coming up.
That's a big deal in the gardens in November. So we have like bulb planting day.
Oh.
And loads of the community come out and we plant all these different bulbs, and like the gardeners spent ages picking the ones that are gonna be the best. So in like a few weeks from now, it's going to be like total colour of bulbs. It'll be beautiful, beautiful.
Fantastic.
There's some ones with really cool names as well. Like there's like Rhododendron Flamingo. And
amazing.
Yeah. I'm like, I like that because I can remember that one.
Yeah.
Polar Bear is another one. I'm like, yeah, that's great. So it's this rhododendron here. And this is like one of its only ones in the UK of its kind. And in the wild, this grows to like, you know, taller than your average tree. It's absolutely massive. I think this one, this is where I'm going to get it all wrong. I think this one is like the Himalayan one. And they took samples from Royal Edinburgh Botanic Gardens to like see if they could propagate it, which is like quite a big deal for them.
Yeah, of course.
Because they didn't have this one in their collection. So we were like, woohoo, 1-0 Ackermore Gardens.
Yeah. So it's a huge, well, to me, to my mind, a huge rhododendron tree. It's got sort of white bell-shaped flowers. It's lovely.
Yeah.
And what's this one called?
This one we think is a Rhododendron Giganteum Grande.
Yeah.
Or Sino Grande, I think it might be. But it's, I just love the ombre, like the pink to the cream.
Yes.
Just think that's absolutely beautiful. And like, what do you reckon that is? 20 feet?
It's got to be more. Well, I'm 5 foot and there's more than four of me.
Well, yeah, so, there you go. More than 20 feet high. And like, that's just not even its natural.
Yeah.
You know, they're like proper arboreal trees in the wild. So it's just, I just think that's crazy. Totally crazy.
What are the plastic bags that are on them?
Oh, this is cool. Okay. So they're grafting bits of rhododendron to like, you know, improve the shape and things. And I don't know a huge lot about grafting rhododendrons. But yeah, it's all to do with the propagation of the plant. Yeah. There's a really lovely rhododendron up here, actually, Lady Horlicks, which was propagated and planted in ode to Jane Horlicks' wife. But then there's another rhododendron in the summer house, and that one is his other wife, but she's got like American tan type colour bark because she was an American. I just absolutely love that story. I think that's really cool.
Andy, you were going to talk about the walking tracks.
Gear has an extensive walking network, so people who've walked the Kintyre Way could come and spend, as you say, a day or two walking one or two of the paths, but there's plenty in my mind to keep people occupied for more time. And spending a week on gear in, as CJ says, various accommodation that's around the place gives you an ideal base to do 3-4 mile walks where you're never too far from the center of the island, but you can enjoy the walking network. Lots of connecting paths, lots of good walking on gravel paths, ideal to spend some time on gear and indulge your passion in. And for me, one of the reasons to come to the island was to enjoy rural life, which I think is great for your mental health, taking in fresh air and just being out in a tranquil place and enjoying the nature, just being in touch with nature, hearing bird song, spotting the odd seal or porpoise now and again is a great thing for me as a city boy.
I think Andy's literally hit the nail on the head, but one thing that was really important when we did the path network was the reasons why we chose the locations that we did. So we had a community steering group and they basically led on where they thought were the locations that we should take people to. But we were also, it's always a double-edged sword because you have to think actually what areas do we want to keep conserved and preserved as well. So we did our best to tie in as many historical heritage features as possible, as well as natural heritage sites. So Andy's right, you know, we've got Garth beaches. I think there might be access to almost every bay on the island now, thanks to the path network. And the Southern Loop is definitely my favourite. I would highly recommend that one because you can see an awful lot of wildlife and it's a beautiful walk.
CJ, you mentioned heritage sites. Could you, or Andy, could you tell us a little bit about the heritage sites that you can visit on these pathways?
To be honest, Gia is completely amazing. So there is history that goes right back to the Bronze Age, all the way through to World War II to now. And obviously, you know, the community buyout is a massive historical event for Gia as well. So we've got Bronze Age burial cairns that are on one of our paths, which is just like an amazing burial site made up of four chambers. They found a woman's body in one of these chambers. There's some really cool legends and things like attached to that, and local ones about, you know, clan warfare and bloody battles and all of that kind of thing. We've got a few standing stones, one of which has got the oldest, or one of the oldest, I should say, Ogham script in Scotland. This is kind of like an old version of Irish language, basically. It's like the primitive version that goes from the top of Scotland all the way down to Cornwall. And one of the best examples is here on Gia. It's kind of like a memorial stone to a previous chieftain. They seem to think, but because it's been worn away, nobody can really read it quite as well anymore. But the stone itself is really interesting. It's made of stone from Ireland, not from Gia. So we know it was brought over even way back in, I think it's the 7th century or something. So it is, it's really interesting what you can actually see here. And then there's Kilchatton Chapel, which is another scheduled monument of ours, which is 13th century, which a lot of people are really interested in. It shows, again, another 15th century chieftain that's buried there. There's a possible, they think, maybe dated when we had a historical environment Scotland over, that there's some sort of Scandinavian Viking burial there too, but again not confirmed. So yeah, there's a really lot, like there's loads of history on Gia. And speaking of Vikings, there's the Viking scales as well, which were found in a field on one of the farms, and they're now in the Hunterian Museum, which were Viking scales. So it's really quite interesting what we've got here.
Absolutely wonderful. Now, being a small island as it is, the beaches must be worth a visit. Do you have any favorite beaches or any secluded spots to recommend?
I have favourite beaches that I won't tell you about because they're a secret to me.
quite right. Too.
I think most people, again, if you take a look at the websites, and as CJ says, that there are beaches at the end of many of the walks, a lot of people's favourite will be the Garb beaches. Take you out to the Garb Peninsula with a north and south facing beach, and that's often what you'll see as photos. But there are many secluded coves around the island, and if you ask seven different people, they'll have seven different favourites. Lane Beach is my particular favourite as part of the Southern Walk.
I would almost agree with you. I think Lane Beach is beautiful, but actually for me, Port Nakara, which is the beach at the very south end of the island, which you come to at the end of the road, so you can't really miss it, is actually my favourite. But that's just because from a biodiversity point of view, it's absolutely fantastic. We've got wading birds, we've got cetaceans, otters are often spotted in that area. You know, the under the sea life, there's lots of anemones, different weeds. It's just absolutely incredible feeding site. And the Sound of Gia is also a stronghold for rare species like great northern divers and red-breasted mergansers, which again is like super amazing that we've got a marine designation just here on our doorstep. So it's a really, really, really cool place to go and visit. Just spend sort of 20 minutes and see what you can see. Guarantee it'll be quite a lot.
We're down at the southern end of Gia. We're going to do the Southern Loop. Come on, Mac. Just going to take about an hour. It's quite windy. And I've got some notes in my bag of, good boy, well done. That's pretty impressive. Three-legged dog jumping over some rocks like a champ. So we're just walking up to, I'm going to get my notes out again, Bodoch and Kayach. Thank you to Alistair Satchell for the pronunciation there. I hope I've done it right. These are two standing stones, the old woman and the old man, Bodoch and Kayach. At noon and night, they walk the heaths of Gia, apparently. kayak, the smaller one, is the goddess of the wilderness and the winter. And they may have links to pre-Christian Ireland. And it's considered extremely bad luck if Bodoch falls. So we're going to keep Mac away from it. So he has a habit of body slamming things. So that's Bodoch and Kayak. That is, so we're on the Southern Loop right now, and it's just a short detour off the main Southern Loop, or there's a bigger loop that you can do back to Achamore Gardens. Here we are, and there's a beautiful view out over the sea as well. Here we are out, looking out over the sea. I hope you can hear me, it's quite windy. We're looking at the Bull of Crero. This is, Mac, come here, darling. Good boy. A rock shaped like a bull, facing northeast. And the facing northeast is the key, because there's a tale about the bull that tells of a cabin boy far from home. His ship was being attacked by pirates. Fearing he would be killed, he prayed to God to protect his mother back home on Gia. And one of the pirates overheard him and knew Gia, and I must have had an affection for it. And he decided to ask him to prove that he was really from Gia. So he asked him which way the bull faced. And on answering correctly, the cabin boy's life was spared. So that's a northeast, should you ever find yourself beholden by some strange riddle by a bunch of pirates. Okay, just coming up to Kilchatten Church. Kilchatten Church. I've got my notes out again. Hang on a second, I've got too many leads and microphones and things. Right. Kilchatten Church, built in the 13th century and dedicated to St. Catan, C-A-T-H-A-N, one of several 6th century Irish missionaries who travelled the Hebrides. It stood 500 years ago, and it leaves richly adorned gravestones, which you can still see, Celtic patterns, swords, tools, and animals. And there's one that's got an otter chasing a salmon, which I'm going to do my best to go and try and find. You all right, Mackers? He's a good boy. All the names have been faded and lost, apart from Malcolm. And they think that the Malcolm is referring to a 15th century chieftain who gained gear. Went back having a drink. Can you hit that? And Puddle, he's got the Jed tendency of never wanting to drink from his bowl. So he's just drinking out of dirty puddles. Yes, Malcolm, a 15th century chieftain who gained gear when the Lord of the Isles resigned Kintyre. The stone carrying his likeness rests in the small enclosure southeast of the church, which I can see. So I'm going to go and have a look at that now.
When you come immediately onto the island, there's an opportunity for cycle hire, but there's also an opportunity to hire canoes and kayaks. And a lot of people will want to bring their own canoes and kayaks onto the island. But boating around the island, kayaking around the island is an ever popular thing. And to see gear from the shores again, as I did last year, I was fortunate enough, someone lent me a canoe. Seeing gear from the shores is, again, a completely different perspective. And linking back to the wildlife that CJ has talked about, you are, if you're traveling by canoe, there's opportunity to see seals basking and other wildlife in the water.
I just wanted to add to that, Andy, about one thing I didn't even mention, which was, I can't believe I haven't said it yet already, is the e-bikes. So there's over 20 e-bikes on hire down at the activity centre. And that was, put in place because we know that actually cycling can be quite tough. And if you've got a family of little ones, that can also be difficult. And there's trailers down there to hire, even the things that you put the dogs in the back. I'm assuming they're also called trailers. Yeah. But there's also beach wheelchairs and trikes. What do you call them? Trikes, is it? Yes.
That's a real thing.
Yeah, so but even for wheelchair users, there are these options as well to get out to our natural spaces, which is a really great thing.
That's great. And that moves us on slightly to food and drink. There's a pretty special seafood restaurant at Gier, is that right?
Yeah, so the Boathouse is a prestigious local restaurant that I think people come to Gier for. But also, one of my favorites here on Gier is the Nook Takeaway, just a short walk again from the ferry terminal located at Ardmini Stores. There's a great little seafood takeaway that operates throughout the summer, serving for me the best fish and chips on the island. And the other eatery I'm about to suggest to anybody who comes to Gier is the Wee Isle Cafe. That serves the local ice cream made at the dairy and is a particular favourite of mine, and one of the reasons I've got so fat and need an e-bike to get me around the place. Yeah, the Nook fish and chips and the Wee Isle Cafe's local ice cream should be on anybody's menu that comes to Gier. The Boathouse is perhaps a bit more of a special treat and probably needs to be booked ahead.
Yeah, just to add to that as well, we've got some amazing local producers here as well. Andy's mentioned one of them, which is the ice cream, but we've also got Gier oysters, which are harvested just in
Absolutely.
two of the bays on Gier, which is great. And they're supplied to our local restaurants as well and further afield. And then as you walk up and down the island, there's literally just stalls of things like baking, sweets, tablet that's also sold in the shop as well. So it's really nice that we have all these very small enterprises that just operate in the visitor season mainly. I mean, you can ask a favour in the winter if you're a local, but it's mainly for the visitors in the summer season. So that's really lovely as well because it kind of gives you that kind of authentic feeling of a very small island. It's really nice.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we've covered beaches, heritage sites, walkways, food, drink, the shop, where to get stuff. Is there anything else
Yeah.
that I need to know before I come to Gier next month?
Yes. So it might interest golfers out there to know we have a nine-hole golf course on the island. I was delighted to buy a house that was only 200 yards from the entrance as a social golfer, and it's a great little course to play for the social golfers and the more accomplished golfers alike. It's not a championship course, and I'm not doing anybody down by saying that, but some of the views from the top of the golf course out to the Kintyre Peninsula are absolutely stunning. And again, if you have time to come and spend time on Gier, 9 holes of golf is a perfect afternoon activity in my book. The other thing I'd like to mention, and is specific to a time period in the summer, is last year, out of COVID, came the Sound of Gear Festival. And the Sound of Gear Festival is again going to run this year. I think it's a weekend in June with music activities based around that. And it would be rude not to mention that if you can come to Gear, or are looking to come to Gier as part of the week of the Sound of Gear Festival is an ideal time to do it. But last but not least, stargazing and the Dark Skies Theatre. Free to everyone, every night on Gier is the night sky, and
Yeah.
it is wonderful.
Yes, we're going to sort of jump around in time now because listeners you'll have already heard the episode on the dark skies. So if you haven't heard that, go back because the dark skies that we're talking about are very much gear based because it is a stunning place to look up at the stars.
One of the things that is just wonderful about Gier is the night sky. We have at the north end of the island a dark skies accredited site at the Dark Skies Theatre, the perfect place to look at the night sky because it was chosen because the light pollution at the north end is the best on the island, but anywhere on Gier. You walk to any of the places and are away from there's no street lighting, there's the odd light from industry accommodation, but you can look at the night sky from pretty much anywhere on Gier for free. So what I would say is to anyone coming to look at the night sky, get prepared. Along with clear night skies comes cold weather. So if you have the perfect clear night conditions, cloud free, then it's going to be cold. Make sure you wrap up warm. Don't get cold out there. And if you're going to go to the extremes of the island to be on your own, be peaceful and use your cameras and take shots, let someone know where you're going. So what we wanted to do when we're looking at the night sky is to avoid light pollution. So that makes gear, anywhere on gear, particularly at the Dark Skies Theatre, the ideal place just to stop and look up. As I say, you want to make sure you're warm and comfortable and don't go stumbling over rocks or anything like that. Take care of yourself. That's why I mentioned mobile phones and letting people know where you are. It's dark. That's one of the downsides of stargazing. Don't lose your footing.
But very much the ups.
Take a torch with you. Ideally, take a red light torch, because what you want to do is avoid all white light for approximately 15 minutes or more to let your eyes become adjusted to the skies. And you don't need any other equipment apart from, your eyesight to look up and see the wonder of the stars. It's absolutely superb. And of absolute wonder, again, when you've come from the cities and you don't really notice more than one or two skies in the night sky, you'll come to gear and you'll have difficulty in picking out constellations simply because there are so many stars piercing that night sky. It's like a canvas that has been spattered with white paint. So what to do when you come and the specific things to look for? Well, of course, any time of the year, there are stars and constellations to look at in the sky. As I've said already, you need the weather to do that. So there are things like the Clear Outside app and photo pills, which many photographers use, that will give you some indication. Of course, the BBC website and other weather sites on the internet will give you clues as well and give you cloud forecasts. Remember as well, when you stargazing, the other big light in the sky is the moon. So look at the state of the moon, what cycle the moon is in, and you ideally want a new moon, not the full moon, which will wash out some of the conditions. So at certain times of the year, you have a lovely view of the Milky Way. And I appreciate you won't get this on a talky podcast, but there are, if you look at the Visit Gear site or some of the sites run by Dark Skies Gear, you'll see some fantastic photos of the Milky Way taken from Gear. And again, that's something that photographers and stargazers alike will want to see. So opportunity to see the Milky Way at certain times of the year, and apps like photo pills or just general other forecasting tools will tell you when the Milky Way is likely to appear in the best times of year to see it with a little bit of research. Stargazing in general, I think, is a fantastic hobby, of which I'm just a beginner myself after years of stargazing. The constellations that appear as zodiac signs are visible throughout the year, and we tend to see the opposite to most people associate with the zodiac. So Sagittarius, for example, will be seen in the summer sky in the northern hemisphere. And so don't go out on your birthday if you want to see Sagittarius. It's my advice there. I am largely ignorant to where constellations are, but I'm starting to learn them. And most people learn them in the way of you recognize one constellation, such as the Plough, and find your way to the next one. So I can recognize things like Orion in the night sky from the belt. And so I know from the belt of Orion that the shoulders of Orion in Betelgeuse, and a name I've now forgotten, that will no doubt come back to me as later on in the conversation. But I can find my way to those stars, and people then associate a bit way like you do in the geography of Europe. You know where France is, you know where Germany is, so you can guess where Italy is and Spain is. And you start to learn more of the map of Europe in that manner, in the same way you do with the sky. So you start to recognize the plough, Orion, maybe Gemini, and go on and start to learn more from there. And again, pretty much all year round, you can look up at the stars and start to recognize some of these constellations in the night sky. So that's great. And to help you with that, there's again many apps that are free and available to use. Stellarium is a good one to start learning the stars. Starwalk is another, and the night sky, all available in the App Store on both Android and Apple phones. You can find those, and they're great. At certain times of the year, there's two more phenomena I'd like to talk about. First of those is meteor showers. And again, if you're using the apps, something like Starwalk will tell you the events that are coming up in the near future to look out for. Big meteor showers are, again, something that are great to see. You have to be patient. It's not like they can come on demand, and you might go out on the night sky on a predicted date and see nothing. Other times you might find yourself that just an extra hour you've seen six or seven more meteors all in quick succession. It's a wonderful thing. Binoculars pointed to the right point in the sky can help with that, but really just enjoying it with the naked eye is a great thing to see. So meteor showers are something that you need to plan ahead, find the right night in the diary, because they are very localized events. And the thing about meteor showers is they are predictable when they are going to happen. So you could look through a calendar of the year and say, at this point in December, right now, I know that a particular meteor shower will happen. So that's one you can plan for. Again, photo pills, Stellarium, Skywalk, all these things will have events on them that you can look up and plan to be in gear on those dates and enjoy it, because gear is ideal portal 2 rating to see that sort of thing. What's less predictable but is amazing phenomena when you see it is the Northern Lights or aurora. Again, this is a much less predictable science. It happens when there are sunspots. I'll get the science wrong, so go and look it up. Don't take my word for this, but CME, coronal mass ejection, I think is the term. Something happens from the sun, hits Earth 48 hours later at the magnetic pole, causes a change in the magnetic pole, and that event triggers what we know as the Northern Lights. That's very ignorant science point of view from a non-expert on the subject. But what it does produce is magnificent colours in the sky. Reds and greens are the most likely to be seen. At times there are purple colours that appear. And all of this phenomenon is absolutely fantastic. But again, requires a lot of patience, a lot of being able to react to the events of perhaps only 48 hours notice, or even at times an hour's notice, because what I'm going to recommend here is that you use apps such as Aurora Forecast, Aurora Watch, or get yourself into the Facebook groups. There's Argyle Auroras very specifically for this area, where like-minded people share aurora forecasts and give indications of when aurora is likely to happen. And I know the chap who runs that group is much, much more of an expert than I am on the subject. And again, there are many more people who are an authority who join that group and share their knowledge quite freely on that. So Facebook groups for Argyle. Kintyre has a group of stargazers, and Dark Skies Gear has a Facebook group also. All of those groups will probably have information from locals on what's happening in the night sky, if there's any events that, like aurora, that can't be predicted way in advance, but you might get hours, if you're lucky, maybe a day or two's notice to get to a great sky watching site to observe. We are at the moment, one of the things about aurora that I will mention is aurora tends to happen in a 10-year cycle and peaks. The peak was predicted to be 2025, but like all sky predictions, it's not an exact science. And we're beginning to see already late 23 and 24 more of these CMEs that I talked about earlier, and stronger CMEs. So they think either there's two things that may have happened because of recent events. Either the prediction was wrong for 25 and 24 is the peak of it, or 25 will still be the peak and it's absolutely massive news in the stargazing community that already we're starting to see the ramp up of aurora, and 24 and 25 will be absolutely amazing years for seeing aurora, if that is true. So get yourself to stargazing spots, start learning the apps, start learning about the sky, and experience some of these natural phenomena.
I have only got two things to say after all that. First thing was, you made an absolutely fantastic point that you do not need to be an expert to do this. And I think actually you don't even need to be that interested in space. It is purely just the act of being in nature at night, which is quite novel for most people, that actually brings that massive benefit mentally and physically to us. The second thing is, from a gear perspective, actually the dark skies helps us hugely with the shoulder season. And I think this is another thing that we're really trying to get right, is to bring people over in the times when actually we're less busy and we could do with a little bit of an economic push. Yeah. And it's also a great time, because not only is the dark skies the best, you've got more chance of seeing the aurora, but the wildlife's actually better on gear here in the winter. You see more birdlife, you see more, we don't see more cetaceans because they're made to September, but you will see more seals, you'll see more hunting predatory birds. So it just lends itself really well to out of the busy summer, hustling, bustling, can't get accommodation anywhere kind of situation, where you can come and do it in the winter. And it is, you know, we're not wild weather here really, most of the time, with the exception of last week, you know, and it's just lovely. So you could do a little bit of like therapy holidaying in the winter for these wonderful things.
TJ makes a very good point that I'll repeat from when we talked about gear in general, that I think the best thing about gear is the tranquility. In the shoulder months and the winter, that's even more appropriate to talk about it. The wildlife, obviously, because of the protection of the dark skies, is fantastic. Just to start reconnecting with nature is a wonderful thing. Stargazing is part of that, but CJ's right to extend what we have from our dark skies is protection of our wildlife and natural habitat in general. That's great. And she's right also to mention that perhaps you won't see the activity you do in summer. So the beauty of coming over in the shoulder months of the winter is the beaches and coves we've mentioned, you often have to yourself. Come and take a week on gear in the winter. Enjoy that tranquility. Enjoy a bit of personal time and mental well-being is a great thing to do, because you do start to get back in touch with nature. And some days will be wet and rainy, admittedly, because we're in Scotland. And of course you get that, but we do have a microclimate here on gear. And often we find ourselves 2 or 3 degrees higher than the mainland and experiencing weather conditions that have going up, go, oh, rain has gone straight over the top of us. It's definitely worth consideration as a place of tranquility to come out of the traditional holiday season.
Thank you so much, CJ and Andy. Just to round up there, could you remind us of the website that people can visit to get the information about GEAR and any social media that they might want to start following?
Yeah, sure. So visitgear.co.uk is our main visitor platform. But that's also on social media if you just typed in Visit GEAR. The Isle of GEAR Heritage Trust also posts and shares lots of different interesting things from across the community. And then the Ranger Service has got a Facebook page and the Instagram page, which is just GEAR Ranger Service.
Thank you so much to CJ and Andy for being my guides for my visit to GEAR. Music for the podcast is provided by Strange Crazy. Thanks once again to our sponsor, JS Salmon Limited, Clacken Hydro.